Hello, welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. This month, why a red t-shirt is the same as a red bum, how a poor sense of smell affects your love life, and going Facebook official, how the social network generation navigate the relationship minefield. This is the January edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk. When you're getting dressed for work or maybe to go out in the evening, how do you decide what to wear? Maybe you check the weather forecast and throw on a few extra layers if the sun isn't shining. Or maybe you think about where you're going and what you'd like to be seen wearing when you get there. I don't know, maybe you close your eyes and grab the first thing off the rack, like I do. But it could also be the case, at least if you're a woman, that the time of the month influences your clothing choices. We already know that women become facially more attractive, speak with more attractive voices, and even smell more attractive around the time of ovulation, when the chances of their becoming pregnant are highest. Researchers have speculated that this might help women to snare the most attractive men when it counts the most. In the same way that chimpanzee and bonobo females develop swollen red backsides during the estrus phase of their cycles, red backsides that the males find irresistible, human females might advertise their own fertility through changes in their appearance, their voice, and their odour. But perhaps the strongest signal comes from the clothes they choose to wear. Researchers have established that women choose to wear more revealing clothes and spend more time on their hair and makeup when they're ovulating. Alec Beale and Jessica Tracy of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver wondered whether women's clothing choices might be about more than how much skin they show. Realising that the colour red is associated with attraction not only in chimpanzees but across the animal kingdom, they decided to test whether women are more likely to dress in red during the fertile middle part of their cycles. Beale and Tracy ran a simple online study. They asked 100 normally cycling, non-pill-using American women what colour shirt they were currently wearing. They also asked the women how long it had been since their last period, which allowed the researchers to work out whether the women were currently ovulating. The women were classified as wearing a red or pink shirt, or a shirt of any other colour. The researchers found that women at the fertile phase of their cycles were substantially more likely to be wearing a red or pink coloured shirt compared to women at the less fertile phases. In fact, around 80% of women who reported that they were wearing red or pink were also near ovulation, making red or pink clothing an extremely good indicator of fertility status. Beale and Tracy suggest that women may choose red clothes because there's a biological link between sex and the colour red. Many animals, male and female alike, advertise their attractiveness with red displays, from the European robin to the stickleback and the chimpanzee. Red may also be associated with arousal, since during sex, the skin is perfused with blood, making it appear redder. There's also a cultural association in the West between the colour red and sex. Think red light districts, red lipstick, and red Valentine's hearts. And although pink was once a colour associated with boys rather than girls, today pink may be the most feminine shade. If one day blue or yellow are seen as the most feminine colours, we might see women choosing clothes of those colours more commonly when they're fertile. It might be a bit disheartening to think that your choice of clothes isn't entirely up to you, and that every 4 weeks your subconscious is working on your behalf to dress you, against your conscious will, as a life-sized Barbie doll. But at least you've got it better than a bonobo. Your bum doesn't turn bright red and inflate to the size of a beach ball. There's a reason why the saying goes, attractiveness is in the eye of the beholder. The sense of sight is extremely important to attraction because often the way a person looks is what draws us to them in the first place. And once our interest is piqued, vision allows us to decipher the meaning of sudden glances, of facial expressions, and of all the complex messages spoken in body language. It's easy to see that if we couldn't see, it would be hard to see who was attractive and who wasn't. But how important are the other senses to attraction? How would our love life change if, for example, we could no longer smell? This was the question asked by Ilona Croy and her colleagues from Germany's University of Dresden Medical School. They recruited 32 men and women who'd been diagnosed with isolated congenital anosmia, or ICA, In other words, people who were born without a sense of smell. They also recruited a similar number of healthy controls, people whose sense of smell was in the normal range. All of the recruits completed a questionnaire about their sex life, stating their lifetime number of sexual partners, age at which they lost their virginity, self-reported sexual satisfaction, and so on. If the sense of smell has no effect on our love life, we'd expect people with anosmia, the inability to smell, to respond to these questions almost identically to people without anosmia. But this wasn't the case. First of all, the results showed that anosmics were much more socially insecure than the healthy controls. People who can't smell were more anxious about their body odour, for obvious reasons. If you can't smell anything, you can't tell if you smell. This increased social insecurity could be to blame for other differences between anosmics and non-anosmics that Croy found. For example, healthy men reported a massive 5 times more sexual relationships than congenitally anosmic men. Croy suggests a plausible explanation for the results, perhaps because anosmic men are unable to detect women's body odour, they're less interested in sex. However, since anosmic and healthy men reported similar levels of sexual satisfaction, this probably isn't what's going on. Instead, it could be that men who can't smell are less confident about approaching women. Or maybe they're less successful at courting those women they do approach. Or, and this is possible too, anosmic men, for some reason, might be less likely to exaggerate their number of sexual partners than men who can smell. Because, to be honest, when a man claims he's bedded more women than James Bond, I think most of us smell a rat. Finally this month, we address perhaps the trickiest question of them all. When should we go Facebook official? It's a question my great-grandmother never had to worry about. All she wanted to know was whether her husband-to-be could afford the train fare for two from Lancashire to Gretna Green, and if he had a ladder she could use to escape her upstairs bedroom, avoiding the vigilant eyes of her parents that were, presumably, trained on the stairs. My parents, who came of age in the mid-70s, probably demanded even less of a commitment. And when I was a teenager in the late 90s, you were anyone's for half a litre of White Lightning. Young people today have got it slightly tougher. How to signal you're committed to a relationship? Marriage is becoming increasingly unfashionable, and you're unlikely to discuss moving in together when the average first-time buyer is 35 years old. Instead, you can choose to make the ultimate commitment, changing your Facebook relationship status from "it's complicated" to "in a relationship." Jesse Fox of the Ohio State University School of Communication investigated how college students navigate the rocky road to Facebook-based romantic success. And it's an investigation worth pursuing. Facebook currently has over 1 billion active monthly users, and 3/4 of young Americans are signed up. College students are particularly heavy users, averaging 1 to 2 hours on the site every day. In the past, American students would advertise their relationship status by wearing their partner's varsity jacket or one of those bracelets with a chap's name on it. I know all this because I've seen Teen Wolf. But nowadays, students can signal their status to many more people and in a fraction of the time by changing their Facebook relationship status. Fox wanted to find out how a person decides when to go Facebook official and how couples negotiate the best time to connect their two accounts and signal to their friends that they're an item. Fox conducted a series of focus groups with Ohio State students and discovered how social networks play a role from the beginning of a relationship right through to full FBO status. The students revealed that they rarely used Facebook to look for a partner. They usually started relationships in the real world, but would exchange Facebook details early on and would conduct most communication with their partner inside of Facebook. Most students said that exchanging Facebook details has supplanted asking for a person's phone number, which many thought was too forward. Perhaps because asking for a person's phone number has a long cultural history. When you ask for a person's number, what you're really saying is you find them attractive. Sending a friend request might be a less loaded message. And the feeling of rejection if the request isn't approved is less intense than it would be in a face-to-face interaction. The students then agreed that the next stage would be creeping a potential partner's page, or perusing it for information without leaving comments to show they'd been there. they suggested that even though nobody would publicly admit to creeping, pretty much everybody does it. They also said they were more likely to delve deeply into their potential partner's history, rather than just simply skimming it, using Facebook's timeline feature, which seems to have been devised for this very purpose. Special attention was usually paid to photographs, especially photographs uploaded by mutual friends, which were thought to be more honest than photographs uploaded by the person themselves. Very little attention, however, was paid to a person's interests. This sort of thing can be easily faked, whereas a picture of a person passed out in a frat house hallway says 1,000 words, and none of them are good. The students agreed that posting a relationship status reduced uncertainty within their social circle. Everybody knows who's off limits and who's free and single. The benefits of announcing your status include letting your rivals know that they should steer clear of your partner. The downside, as one student put it, is that your status becomes everybody's business, not just your own. Relationship problems take on a life of their own when things that would ordinarily be between two people end up involving those people's friends, acquaintances, and the girl you sat next to in 8th grade biology. Going Facebook official, when your partner's name appears next to your own relationship status, was seen as a way of taking a relationship to another level, and generally took place weeks or months after the start of a relationship. The students agreed that going Facebook official meant a couple was exclusive and off the market. Relationships that were not FBO were viewed with scepticism. If a couple said they were in a relationship, but they weren't FBO, their friends were not likely to think that relationship was serious. In an inversion of the traditional distinction between real and virtual worlds, the students suggested that a lot of people don't consider a relationship real until it's on Facebook. Men were more likely than women to claim that their partner put pressure on them to go FBO, perhaps because making a public statement of attachment makes it more difficult for men to pursue flings. If a girl makes a guy go FBO, it means there's less chance of him finding a new partner. Generally, the students claimed that Facebook made relationships more difficult, as it provided too much information to keep track of. It was easy to lose track, to displease high-maintenance partners, and to make a fool of yourself in front of your friends. Many thought it was likely they'd quit Facebook in the future to avoid the drama. Some already had, and some of those had been drawn back in shortly after. I've been in my current relationship since before Facebook was created, so I'm bound to think I've had it easy in comparison to today's young people. The most complicated it ever got for me was at the age of 16, when I carried out a long-distance relationship entirely by letters, not emails, actual letters, and one phone call a week, which had to be on a Sunday when phone calls were cheapest because we didn't have mobile phones and had to use our parents' landlines. I'm only 31, and that's not young, but I didn't feel old until today, because apparently I grew up in a 19th century novel. I have less in common, romantically speaking, with today's youth than I do with Anna Karenina and Vronsky. Anyway, that's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. Grandpa Rob Burris.